and the detective would need to submit a request for testing. I can tell you right now it's not going to happen. No one's going to throw valuable resources at something that might not even be a crime to begin with. Missing persons and cold cases and the general unit will bounce this back and forth between them for a few months until they get bored, give up, and file it in a basement somewhere. You need to be prepared for that. Nora asked, "But what about you? Could you not put in the request?" I shook my head ruefully. "Not officially, no. No matter how far you stretch it, this definitely isn't something my squad would deal with. Once it goes into the system, there is nothing I can do about it." "But," Nora said. She was sitting up straighter, alert, watching me. "If it wasn't in the system, like, if it was just you, could you... Is there not a way to...
call in a few favours on the QT?
I raised my eyebrows. Had a think about that. "Well, I guess it could be done. You'd all need to be positive that that's what you want, though." "I do," Nora said straight off. A fast decider, same as Rosie. "If you'd do that for us, Francis, if you could. Please." Mrs. Daly nodded, fished in her sleeve for a tissue and blew her nose. "Could she not be in England after all, could she not?" She was begging me. The note in her voice hurt. Kevin flinched. "She could," I said gently. "Yeah. If you want to leave this with me, I suppose I could try to check that out too."
"Ah, God," Mrs. Daly said under her breath. "Ah, God."
I asked, "Mr. Daly?" There was a long silence. Mr. Daly sat there with his hands clasped between his knees, staring at the suitcase like he hadn't heard me. Finally he said to me, "I don't like you. You are your family, no point pretending." "Yeah," I said. "I noticed that along the way. But I'm not here as one of the Mackies. I'm here as a police officer who might be able to help you find your daughter."
"On the QT, under the table, through the back door. People don't change."
"Apparently not," I said, giving him a bland smile. "But circumstances do. We're on the same side this time."
"Are we?"
"You'd better hope so," I said, "because I'm the best you've got. Take it or leave it." His eyes came up to mine then, a long, raking stare. I kept my back straight and did my respectable face from parent-teacher meetings. Finally, he nodded, one sharp jerk, and said, not all that graciously,
"Do it. Whatever you can. Please."
"Right," I said, and got out my notebook. "I'll need you to tell me about Rosie leaving. Start from the day before, in as much detail as you can, please." They knew it by heart, just like every family that's lost a child. I once had a mother show me which glass her son drank out of the morning before he took his overdose. A Sunday morning in Advent, cold with a grey-white sky and breath hanging in the air like fog. Rosie had come in early the night before, so she had gone to 9 o'clock Mass with the rest of the family, rather than sleeping in and getting the noon Mass, the way she did if she'd been out late on Saturday night. They'd come home and made a fry-up for breakfast. Back then, eating before Holy Communion earned you a string of Hail Marys at your next confession. Rosie had done the ironing while her mother washed up, and the two of them had discussed when to buy the ham for Christmas dinner. It grabbed my breath for a second, the thought of her calmly talking about a meal she had no plans to eat, and dreaming about a Christmas that would be just hers and mine. A little before noon, the girls had walked over to New Street to pick up their Nana Daly for Sunday dinner, after which they had all watched the telly for a while. That was another thing that had put the Dalys a cut above us peasants. They actually owned their own TV. Reverse snobbery is always fun. I was rediscovering subtle nuances that I'd almost forgotten existed. The rest of the day was more nothing. The girls had walked their Nana home,
Nora had headed out to hang around with a couple of her mates, and Rosie had gone to her room to read, or possibly to pack, or to write that note, or to sit on the edge of her bed and take a lot of deep breaths. Tea, more housework, more telly, helping Nora with her maths homework. There hadn't been a single sign anywhere in that day that Rosie had anything up her sleeve. "An angel," Mr. Daly said grimly. "All that week, she was an angel. I should have known." Nora had gone to bed around 10:30, the rest of the family a little after 11. Rosie and her da had to be up for work in the morning. The two girls shared one back bedroom, their parents had the other. No pull-out sofas for the Dalys, thanks very much. Nora remembered the rustle of Rosie changing into her pyjamas, and the whisper of night as she slid into bed, and then nothing. She hadn't heard Rosie get out of bed again, hadn't heard her get dressed, hadn't heard her slip out of the room or out of the flat. "I slept like the dead back then," she said defensively, like she had taken a lot of flack about this along the way. "I was a teenager. You know what they're like." In the morning, when Mrs. Daly went to wake the girls, Rosie was gone. At first, they didn't worry any more than my family were worrying across the road. I got the sense Mr. Daly had been a bit snotty about inconsiderate modern youth, but that was all. It was Dublin in the '80s. It was safe as houses. They thought she had headed out early to do something, maybe meet the girls for some mysterious girl reason. Then, around the time Rosie was missing breakfast, the Shaughnessy boys and Barry Hearn had shown up with the note. It was unclear what the three of them had been doing in number 16, bright and early on a cold Monday morning, but I would have bet on either hash or porn. There were a couple of precious magazines doing the rounds, smuggled in by someone's cousin who'd been over to England the year before. Either way, that was when all hell had broken loose. The Daily's account was a little less vivid than Kevin's. His eyes slid sideways to catch mine once or twice while they were giving us their version. But the general outline was the same. I nodded at the case. "Where was that kept?" "The girls' room," Mrs. Daly said, into her knuckles. "Rosie had it to hold her spare clothes and her old toys and all. We didn't have the fitted wardrobes then, sure. No one did."
"Think back. Do any of you remember the last time you saw it?"
No one did. Nora said, "It could have been months before. She kept it under her bed. I'd only see it when she brought it out to get something."
"What about the things inside it? Can you remember when you last saw Rosie using any of that stuff? Playing those tapes, wearing any of those clothes?"
Silence. Then Nora's back snapped straight, and she said, her voice gone up a notch,
"The Walkman! I saw that on the Thursday, 3 days before she went. I used to take it out of her bedside locker when I got home from school, and listen to her tapes till she got in from work. If she caught me, she'd give me a clatter round the ear, but it was worth it. She had the best music."
"What makes you so sure you saw it on the Thursday?"
"That's when I'd borrow it. Thursdays and Fridays, Rosie used to walk to work and back with Imelda Tierney. Do you remember Imelda? She did the sewing with Rosie down at the factory. So she wouldn't take the Walkman. The rest of the week, Imelda had a different shift, so Rosie walked in on her own, and she'd bring the Walkman to listen to."
"So you could have seen it on either Thursday or Friday."
Nora shook her head. "Fridays we used to go to the pictures after school, a gang of us. I went that Friday. I remember because..."
She flushed, shut up, and glanced sideways at her father.
Mr. Daly said flatly, "She remembers because, after Rosie ran off, it was a long time before I let Nora out gallivanting again. We'd lost one by being too lax. I wasn't going to risk the other."
"Fair enough," I said, nodding away like that was perfectly sane.
"And none of you remembers seeing any of those items after Thursday afternoon?"
Headshakes all round. If Rosie hadn't been packed by Thursday afternoon, she'd been cutting it a little close to find a chance of hiding that suitcase herself, especially given Daddy's Doberman tendencies. The odds were starting to shade ever so slightly towards someone else doing the hiding.
I asked, "Had you noticed anyone hanging around her, giving her hassle? Anyone who worried you?"
Mr. Daly's eye said, What? Apart from you?
But he managed not to share. He said evenly, If I'd noticed anyone bothering her, I'd have sorted it out.
Any arguments, problems with anyone?
Not that she told us about.
You'd probably know about that kind of thing better than we would.
We all know how much girls tell their parents at that age.
I said, One last thing.
I fished in my jacket, pulled out a bunch of envelopes just big enough to hold a snapshot, and handed out three of them. Do any of you recognize this woman? The dailies gave it their best shot, but no 100-watt bulbs lit up, presumably because Fingerprint Fifi is a high school algebra teacher from Nebraska whose photo I pulled off the internet. Wherever I go, Fifi goes. Her picture has a nice wide white border, so you won't feel the need to hold it delicately by the edges, and since she may be the most nondescript human being on the planet, it'll take you a close look, probably involving both thumbs and index fingers, to be sure that you don't know her. I owe my girl Fifi many a subtle ID. Today, she was going to help me find out whether the dailies had left prints on that suitcase. What had my antennae wiggling at this lot was the mind-bending off chance that Rosie had been heading to meet me after all. If she was sticking to our plan, if she didn't need to dodge me, she would have taken the same route I had, out the door of the flat, down the stairs, straight into the place. But I had had a perfect view of every inch of the road the whole night through, and that front door had never opened. Back then, the Dailies had the middle floor of number 3. On the top floor were the Harrison sisters, three ancient, easily overexcited spinsters who gave you bread and sugar if you did their messages for them. The basement was sad, sick little Veronica Crotty, who said her husband was a travelling salesman, and her sad, sick little kid. In other words, if someone had intercepted Rosie on her way to our rendezvous, that someone was sitting across the coffee table from me and Kevin. All three of the Dailies looked genuinely shocked and upset, but that can swing so many ways. Nora had been a big kid at a difficult age, Mrs. Daly was somewhere on the crazy spectrum, and Mr. Daly had a 5-star temper, a 5-star problem with me, and muscles. Rosie was no lightweight. Her da might not be Arnie, after all, but he had been the only one in that house strong enough to dispose of her body. Mrs. Daly asked, peering anxiously over the photo, Who's she now? I've never seen her about. Do you think she might have hurt our Rosie? She looks awful small for that, does she not? Rosie was a strong girl. She wouldn't...
I'd say she has nothing to do with it, I told her truthfully, retrieving the photo envelopes and slipping them back into my pocket, in order. I'm just exploring every possibility.
Nora said, But you think someone hurt her?
It's too early to assume that, I said. I'll set some inquiries in motion and keep you posted. I think I've got enough to start with. Thanks for your time. Kevin leaped out of his seat like he was on springs. I took off my gloves to shake their hands goodbye. I didn't ask for phone numbers, no sense in pushing my welcome, and I didn't ask if they still had the note. The thought of seeing it again made my jaw clench. Mr. Daly walked us out. At the door he said abruptly to me, "What you never wrote, we thought it was you that wouldn't let her." This could have been some form of apology, or just one final dig. Rosie never let anyone stop her from doing what she wanted to do, I said. I'll get back to you as soon as I have any information. As he closed the door behind us, I heard one of the women starting to cry. Chapter 4 The rain had slackened off to a faint, damp haze. But the clouds were getting denser and darker. There was more on the way. Ma was pressed up against the front room window, sending out curiosity rays that practically burned my eyebrows off. When she saw me looking in her direction, she whipped up a J-cloth and started furiously cleaning the glass. "Nicely done," I said to Kevin. "I appreciate that." He shot me a quick sideways glance. "That was weird. His own big brother, the same one who used to nick crisps from the shop for him, in full cop mode.
Didn't show, I told him approvingly.
You worked it like a pro. You've got a knack for this, do you know that?
He shrugged.
Now what? I'm going to put this in my car before Matt Daly has a change of heart, I said, balancing the case on one arm and giving Ma a wave and a big grin. And then I'm going to go have a little chat with someone I used to know. Meanwhile, you're going to wrangle Ma and Da for me. Kevin's eyes widened in horror. Ah, Jesus, no. No way. She'll still be raging about the breakfast. Come on, Kev, tighten up your jockstrap and take one for the team.
Team, my arse! You're the one pissed her off to begin with, and now you want me to go back in there and take all the flack?
His hair was sticking up with outrage. Bingo, I said. I don't want her hassling the dailies, and I don't want her spreading the word, at least not right away.
All I need is an hour or so before she starts doing damage. Can you give me that? What am I supposed to do if she starts heading out? Rugby tackle her?
What's your phone number? I found my mobile, the one my boys and my informants use, and sent Kev a text that said, Hi. There, I said. If Ma escapes, you just reply to that, and I'll come rugby tackle her myself. Fair enough?
Fucking hell, Kevin muttered, staring up at the window. Nice one, I said, clapping him on the back.
You're a trooper. I'll meet you back here in an hour, and I'll get you a few pints tonight. How's that?
I'll need more than a few, Kev said gloomily, and he squared up his shoulders and headed off to face the firing squad.
I stashed the suitcase safely in the boot of my car, ready to take to a lovely lady in the technical bureau whose home address I happened to know. A handful of 10-year-olds with underprivileged hair and no eyebrows were slouched on a wall, scoping out the cars and thinking wire hangers. All I needed was to come back and find that suitcase gone. I leaned my arse on the boot, labelled my fingerprint Fifi envelopes, had a smoke, and stared our country's future out of it until the situation was clear all round and they fucked off to vandalise someone who wouldn't come looking for them. The Daly's flat had been the mirror image of ours. There was nowhere to stash a body, at least not long term. If Rosie had died in that flat, then the Daly's had had two options. Assuming Mr. Daly was the proud owner of one serious set of cojones, which I didn't rule out, he could have wrapped her up in something and carried her out the front door and away. Into the river, onto some abandoned site, into the piggeries as per Shay's charming suggestion. But the liberties being the liberties, the odds were high that someone would have seen it, remembered it, and talked about it. Mr. Daly didn't strike me as a gambling man. The non-gambler's option was the back garden. Probably nowadays, half the gardens had been dolled up with shrubs and decking and various wrought iron doodads, but back then they were neglected and ragged. Scrawny grass, dirt, boards and broken furniture, and the odd wrecked bike. Nobody went out there except to use the toilet or, in summer, to hang washing. All the action was out front in the street. It had been cold, but not cold enough to freeze the ground. An hour one night to start digging a grave, maybe another hour the next night to finish it, another the third night to fill it in. No one would spot you. The gardens didn't have lighting. On dark nights you needed a torch just to find your way to the jacks. No one would hear you. The Harrison sisters were deaf as a pair of fence posts. The back windows of Veronica Crotty's basement were boarded up to keep the heat in. Everyone else's windows would have been shut tight against the December cold. Cover the grave, during the days when you were all finished, with a sheet of corrugated iron or an old table or whatever was lying around. No one would look twice. I couldn't get into that garden without a warrant, and I couldn't get one of those without something that bore a passing resemblance to probable cause. I threw my smoke away and headed back to Faithful Place to talk to Mandy Brophy. Mandy was the first person who was unequivocally, unmistakably glad to see me. The scream out of her nearly lifted the roof off. I knew it would send my ma scurrying for the window again.
"Francis Mackey, Jesus, Mary and Holy Saint Joseph!"
She pounced and caught me in a hug that left bruises.
"You nearly gave me a heart attack. I thought I'd never see you around these parts again. What are you doing here?"
She was mammy-shaped these days, with mammy hair to match, but the dimples were still the same. "This and that," I said, smiling back. It seemed like a good moment to see how everyone was getting on.
"About feckin' time is all I can say. Come in out of that. Here, use."
Two dark-haired, round-eyed little girls were sprawled on the front room floor.
"Go on upstairs and play in your room. Give me some peace while I talk to this fella here. Go on."
She shooed the girls out with her hands. "They're the image of you," I said, nodding after them.
"They're a pair of little wagons, so they are. They've me worn out. I'm not joking you. My ma says it's my comeuppance for all the times I put the heart crossways in her when I was a young one."
She whipped half-dressed dolls and sweet wrappers and broken crayons off the sofa.
"Now come here to me. I hear you're in the guards now. Very respectable you're after getting."
She was holding the armful of toys and smiling up at me, but those black eyes were sharp and watchful. She was testing. "You'd think," I said, dropping my head and giving her my finest bad boy grin. "I grew up is all. Same as yourself." She shrugged.
"I'm the same as ever, sure. Look around you."
"So am I. You can take the fella out of the place."
"But you can't take the place out of the fella."
Her eyes stayed wary for another second. Then she nodded, a quick little snap, and pointed a brat's foot at the sofa.
"Sit down there now. You'll have a cup of tea, yeah?"
And I was in. There's no password more powerful than your past. Ah, Jesus, no. I'm only after my breakfast. Mandy tossed the toys into a pink plastic toy box and slammed the lid.
"Are you sure? Then do you mind if I fold the washing while we're talking, before those two little madams come back and have the place turned upside down again?"
She plumped down on the sofa next to me and pulled a washing basket closer.
"Did you hear I married Jer Brophy? He's a chef now. He always did love his food, Jer did."
"Gordon Ramsay, yeah?" I said, and gave her a wicked grin. "Tell me something. Does he bring his spatula home with him, in case you're bold?" Mandy squealed and smacked my wrist.
"You dirty bastard. You're the same as ever, aren't you?" "Ah, he's no Gordon Ramsay. He's at one of them new hotels up by the airport. He says it does be mostly families that missed their flights and businessmen looking to take their fancy women somewhere they won't be snared.
Nobody minds about the food."
"One morning, I swear, he was that bored he put bananas in the breakfast fry-ups, just to see what they would do. No one said a feckin' word."
"They must have thought it was nouvelle cuisine. Fair play to Jer."
"I don't know what they thought it was,
but all of them ate it. Egg and sausage and banana." I said, "Jer's a sound man. You both did well there." She shook out a little pink sweatshirt with a snap.
"Ah, sure, he's all right. He's a good laugh. It was always on the cards anyway. When we told my ma we were engaged, she said she'd seen it coming since we were in diapers. Same as with..."
A quick glance up.
"Same as with most of the weddings round here."
Back in the day, Mandy would have heard all about that suitcase by this time, complete with detailed, gory speculation. The decayed grapevine plus my man Kevin's sterling work with Ma meant that she wasn't tense and she wasn't being careful. Just a little tactful so as not to hurt my wounded feelings. I relaxed back into the sofa and enjoyed it while it lasted. I love messy homes. Homes where a woman and kids have left their mark on every inch. Sticky finger marks down the walls, trinkets and nests of pastel hair gadgets on the mantelpiece, that smell of flowery things and ironing. We shot the breeze for a while. Her parents, my parents, various neighbours who had got married or had kids, or moved out of the suburbs or developed intriguing health problems. Imelda was still around, a 2-minute walk away on Hallows Lane, but something at the corners of Mandy's mouth told me they didn't see as much of each other anymore, and I didn't ask. Instead, I made her laugh. Get a woman laughing, and you're halfway to getting her talking. She still had the same round, bubbly giggle that exploded out of her and made you want to laugh too. It took 10 minutes or so before Mandy asked, casually, "So tell us, did you ever hear anything from Rosie?" Not a dicky bird, I said, just as easily. You?
Nothing.
I thought. That glance again. I thought you might have, that's all. I asked. Did you know? Her eyes were down on the socks she was rolling, but her lashes flickered.
What do you mean?
You and Rosie were close. I thought she might have told you.
That yous were elopin', like, or that she...
Either one. She shrugged.
Ah, Jesus, Mandy, I said, putting a humorous twist on it. It's been 20-odd years, I can promise you. I'm not going to throw a wobbler because girls talk to each other. I only wondered. I hadn't a notion she was thinking of breaking it off. Honest to God, not a clue.
I have to tell you, Francis, when I heard yous weren't together, I was only gobsmacked. I thought for definite you'd have been married with half a dozen kids to put a stop to your gallop.
So, you did know we were planning on heading off together?
Yous went off the same night, sure. Everyone figured.
I grinned at her and shook my head.
Breaking it off, you said. You knew we were still seeing each other. We'd been keeping that under wraps for almost 2 years, or at least I thought we had been.
After a moment, Mandy made a wry little face at me and tossed the socks into the washing basket.
Smart arse. It's not that she was spilling her guts to us or nothing. She never said a word right up until...
Did you and Rosie meet up for a few drinks about a week before yous left? Somewhere in town, I think it was.
O'Neill's. On Pierce Street, and all the college boys' heads turning as Rosie made her way back to our table with a pint in each hand. She was the only girl I knew who drank pints, and she always stood her round.
Yeah, I said, we did.
That was what did it. See, she told her da she was going out with me and Imelda, but she never said it to us so we could cover for her. Know what I mean? Like I said, she'd been keeping you very quiet. We hadn't a notion. But that night the pair of us got home early enough, and Mr. Daly was watching out the window and he saw us come in, without Rosie. She didn't get in till late.
Mandy dimpled up at me. Yous must have had loads to talk about, did you?
Yeah, I said. Goodnight kiss pressed up against the wall of Trinity, my hands on her hips, pulling her close.
Mr. Daly waited up for her anyway. Rosie called round to me the next day, the Saturday it was, and she said he went ballistic.
And we were right back to big bad Mr. Daly again.
I bet he did, I said.
Me and Imelda asked where she'd been, but she wouldn't say. All she would say was that her da was livid, so we guessed she must have been meeting you.
I always wondered, I said. What the hell did Matt Daly have against me?
Mandy blinked.
God, I wouldn't have a clue. Himself and your owl fella don't get on. I'd say it might be that.
Does it matter, sure? You're not around here anymore. You never see him.
I said, Rosie dumped me, Mandy. She dumped me flat on my arse, out of the clear blue sky. And I've never known why. If there's an explanation somewhere out there, I'd love to know what it is. I'd like to know if there was something, anything I could have done to make things turn out different.
I gave it plenty of the strong but suffering, and Mandy's mouth went soft with sympathy.
Ah, Francis. Rosie never gave a tinker's damn what her da thought of you. You know that.
Maybe not. But if she was worried about anything or hiding something from me, or if she was scared of someone...
How livid did he used to get with her, exactly?
Mandy looked baffled or wary, I couldn't tell which.
How do you mean, like?
Mr. Daly had a temper, I said. When he first found out Rosie was seeing me, the whole place heard him roaring. I always wondered if it stopped there, or if...
Well,
if he used to hit her. Her hand went to her mouth.
Jesus, Francis, did she say something?
Not to me, but she wouldn't have, not unless she wanted me punching her da's lights out. I thought she might have talked to you and Imelda, though.
Ah, no. God, no. She never said a word about anything like that.
I think she would have, but...
You never know for definite. Sure you don't.
Mandy thought, smoothing a blue school uniform tunic in her lap.
"I'd say he never laid a finger on her," she said, in the end. "And I'm not just saying that because you want to hear it now. Half Mr. Daly's problem was that he never copped that Rosie had grown up, do you know what I mean? That Saturday, when she called round to me after he'd caught her coming home late, the three of us were meant to be going up to the apartments that night, and Rosie couldn't go because, I'm not joking you, her da had taken her keys away. Like she was a kid, instead of a grown woman putting her wages on the table every week. He said he was locking the door at 11 sharp, and if she wasn't in by then, she could sleep on the street. And you know yourself, by 11 the apartments were only getting started. See what I mean? When he got annoyed with her, he didn't give her the slaps. He sent her to sit in the corner, the way I do with one of my little young ones if she was bold.
And just like that, Mr. Daly no longer had the spotlight all to himself. Getting a search warrant for his garden was no longer top priority, and snuggling up in Mandy's cosy little corner of domestic bliss wasn't as much fun anymore. If Rosie hadn't come out the front door of her house, it didn't have to be because she was dodging me, or because Daddy had caught her in the act and had a melodrama moment involving a blunt object. It could have been just because he had left her no choice. Front doors were locked at night. Back doors had a bolt on the inside, so you could go to the Jack's shed without needing a key or locking yourself out. Without her keys, it didn't matter whether Rosie was running away from me or into my arms. She had had to go out the back door, over the walls and down the gardens. The odds were spreading out, away from number three. And the chances of pulling prints off that case were going down. If Rosie had known she was going to be monkeying around with garden walls, she would have hidden the case in advance, ready to pick up on her way out of town. If someone had got his hands on her along the way, he might never even have known the suitcase existed. Mandy was watching me, a little worried, trying to work out if I got what she meant. "Makes sense," I said. "I can't see Rosie taking well to being sent to the corner, though. Was she planning on trying something? Nicking her keys back from her dad, maybe?" "Not a thing. That's what tipped us off something was up, sure. Me and Imelda said to her, 'Fuck him, come out with us anyway. If he locks you out, you can sleep here.' But she said no. She wanted to keep him sweet. We said, 'Why would you be arsed? Like you said, it wasn't her style.' And Rosie said, 'Sure, it's not for much longer.' That got our attention, all right. The pair of us dropped everything and jumped on her, wanting to know what she was on about, but she wouldn't say. She acted like she just meant her dad would give the keys back soon enough. But both of us knew it was more than that. We didn't know what, exactly. Just that something big was happening."
"You didn't try for more details? What she had planned, when, whether it was with me?"
"God, yeah. We went on at her for ages. I was poking her in the arm and all, and Imelda smacked her with a pillow trying to make her talk. But she just ignored us till we gave up and went back to getting ready. She was... Jesus."
Mandy laughed, a soft, startled little catch under her breath. Her brisk hands on the washing had slowed to a stop.
"We were just through there, in that dining room. That used to be my room. I was the only one of us had my own room. We always met up there. Me and Imelda were doing our hair, back combing away. God, the state of us, and the turquoise eyeshadow, do you remember? We thought we were the Bangles and Cyndi Lauper and Bananarama all rolled into one."
"You were beautiful," I said, and meant it. "All three of you. I've never seen prettier." She wrinkled her nose at me. Flattery will get you nowhere. But her eyes were still somewhere else. "We were slagging Rosie, asking her was she joining the nuns, telling her she'd look lovely in a habit, and was it because she fancied Father McGrath? Rosie was lying on my bed, looking up at the ceiling and biting her nail. You know the way she used to do? Just the one fingernail."
"Right index fingernail. She bit at it when she was thinking hard. Those last couple of months, while we made our plans, she'd drawn blood a few times."
"I remember," I said.
"I was watching her in the mirror on my dressing table. It was Rosie.
I knew her since the lot of us were babas together, and all of a sudden she looked like a new person. Like she was older than us. Like she was already halfway gone, somewhere else. I felt like we should give her something. A goodbye card or a St. Christopher medal, maybe. Something for a safe journey.
I asked, "Did you mention this to anyone?"
"No way," Mandy said, fast, with a snap in her voice. "No way would I have squelled on her. You know better than that."
She was sitting up straighter, starting to bristle. "I do, babe," I said, smiling across at her. "I'm only double-checking out of habit. Don't mind me."
"I talked to Imelda, all right. We both figured yous were eloping. We thought it was dead romantic. Teenagers, you know yourself. But I never said a word to anyone else, not even after. We were on your side, Francis. We wanted yous to be happy."
For one split second, I felt like if I turned around, I would see them. In the next room. Three girls restless on that edge where everything was just about to happen, sparkling with turquoise and electricity and possibilities. "Thanks, honey," I said. "I appreciate that."
I haven't a clue why she changed her mind. I tell you if I did. The two of yous were perfect for each other. I thought for sure.
Her voice trailed off.
"Yeah," I said. "So did I."
Mandy said softly, "God, Francis." Her hands were still holding the same little uniform tunic, not moving. And there was a long, invincible current of sadness under her voice.
"God, it's an awful long time ago, isn't it?"
The road was quiet. Only the sing-song murmur of one of the little girls explaining something to the other upstairs. And the rush of wind sweeping a gust of fine rain past the windows.
"It is," I said. "I don't know how it got to be so long."
I didn't tell her. Let my ma do it. She would enjoy every second. We hugged goodbye at the door, and I kissed Mandy's cheek and promised to call round again soon. She smelled of sweet, safe things I hadn't smelt in years. Pear soap, and custard creams, and cheap perfume.
Chapter 5. Kevin was slumped against our railings, looking the way he used to when we were kids, and he got left behind for being too little. Except that now he had a mobile, and he was texting away at top speed.
"Girlfriend?" I said, nodding at the phone.
He shrugged. "Sort of, I guess. Not really. I'm not into settling down yet."
"That means you've got a few of them on the go. Kev, you dirty dog."
He grinned. "So? They all know the story. They're not into settling down either. We're just having a laugh. Nothing wrong with that."
"Nothing at all," I agreed. "Except I thought you were wrangling Ma for me, not playing fingers of love with today's laugh. What happened to that?"
"I'm wrangling her from here. She was doing my head in. If she'd tried to go across to the Dailies, I'd have caught her."
"I don't want her ringing the whole world on his wife."
"She won't ring anyone, not till she's called around to Mrs. Daly and got all the ska.
She's doing the washing up and giving out. I tried to give her a hand and she threw a freaker because I put a fork in the drain a wrong way up and someone was going to fall on it and lose an eye. So I split."
"Where were you? Were you in with Mandy Brophy?"
I said,
"Let's say you wanted to get from number 3 to the top of the place, but you couldn't go out the front door. What would you do?"
"Back door," Kevin said promptly, going back to texting.
"Over the garden walls. Did it a million times."
"Me too."
I aimed a finger along the line of houses from number 3 up to number 15 at the top. 6 gardens. 7, counting the Dailies. Rosie could still be waiting for me in any one of them.
"Hang on."
Kevin looked up from his phone. "Do you mean now, or way back when?"
"What's the difference?"
"The Haley's bloody dog, that's the difference. Rambo, remember him? The little bastard bit the arse out of me trousers that time."
"Jesus," I said. "I'd forgotten that little fucker. I drop-kicked him once."
Rambo was, naturally, some kind of terrier-based mutt that weighed about 5 pounds soaking wet. The name had given him a Napoleon complex, complete with territorial issues. Now that Number Five's those Aegis in their Teletubby paint, I'd go the way you said. Kevin pointed along the same line I'd drawn. But back then, with Rambo waiting to rip me a new one, not a chance. I'd go that way. He turned, and I followed his finger, down past Number One, along the high wall at the bottom of the place, up the even-numbered gardens, over the wall of Number 16, to that lamppost. I asked, "Why not just come back over the bottom wall and straight up the road? Why would you be arsed with the gardens on our side?" Kevin grinned. "I can't believe you don't know this shit. Did you never go throwing rocks up at Rosie's window?" "Not with Mr. Daly in the next room. I like having testicles." "I was buzzing off Linda Dwyer for a while when we were like 16. Remember the Dwyers in Number One? We used to meet in her back garden at night, so she could stop me putting my hand up her top. That wall," he pointed to the bottom of the road, "on the other side, it's smooth. No footholds. You can only get over it at the corners, where you can use the other wall to pull yourself up. That takes you into the back gardens." "You're a fountain of knowledge," I said. "Did you ever get into Linda Dwyer's bra?" Kevin rolled his eyes and started explaining Linda's complex relationship with the Legion of Mary. But I was thinking. I had a hard time picturing a random psycho killer or sex attacker hanging around back gardens on a Sunday night, hoping forlornly that a victim would stroll by. If someone had nabbed Rosie, he had known her. He had known she was coming, and he had had at least the basics of a plan. Over the back wall was Copper Lane, a lot like Faithful Place, only bigger and busier. If I had wanted to arrange any kind of clandestine meeting or ambush or what have you, along the route Kevin had pointed out, especially a clandestine meeting that might involve a struggle or a body dump, I would have used Number 16. Those noises I had heard, while I waited under the lamppost shifting from foot to keep from freezing. A man grunting, stifled squeaks from a girl, bumping sounds. A teenage guy in love is a walking pair of nads wearing rose-coloured glasses. I'd taken it for granted that love was everywhere. I believed Rosie and I were so wild about each other that it got in the air like a shimmering drug, that night when everything was coming together, and swirled through the Liberties, sending everyone who breathed it into a frenzy. Wrecked factory workers reaching for each other in their sleep, teenagers on corners suddenly kissing like their lives depended on it, old couples spitting out their falsies and ripping off each other's flannel nighties. I took it for granted that what I was hearing was a couple doing the do. I could have been wrong. It took a mind-bending effort to assume, just for a second, that she had been coming to me after all. If she had, then the note said she had very probably made it along Kevin's route as far as Number 16. The suitcase said she had never made it out. "Come on," I said, cutting off Kev, who was still going, "Wouldn't have bothered, only she had the biggest rack in the..." "Let's go play where Mammy said we shouldn't." Number 16 was in even worse shape than I'd thought. There were big gouges all the way down the front steps where the builders had dragged the fireplaces away, and someone had nicked the wrought iron railings on either side, or maybe the property king had sold them too. The whacking great sign announcing P.J. Lavery Builders had fallen down the well by the basement windows. Nobody had bothered to retrieve it. Kevin asked, "What are we doing?" "We're not sure yet," I said, which was true enough. All I knew was that we were following Rosie, feeling our way step by step and seeing where she led us. "We'll find out as we go, yeah?" Kevin poked the door open and leaned forward gingerly to peer in. "If we don't end up in hospital first." The hallway was a tangle of criss-crossing shadows, layered half a dozen deep where faint light seeped in from every angle. From the empty rooms with their doors pulled half off, through the filthy glass of the landing window, down the high stairwell, along with the cold breeze. I found my torch. I may be out of the field officially, but I still like being ready for the unexpected. I picked my leather jacket because it's comfortable enough that it almost never comes off, and it has enough pockets to hold all the basics. Fingerprint Fifi, 3 small plastic evidence bags, notebook and pen, Swiss Army knife, cuffs, gloves, and a slim, high-powered maglite. My Colt Detective Special goes in a specially made harness that keeps it snug at the small of my back, under my jeans waistband, and out of sight. "I'm not joking," Kevin said, squinting up the dark stairs. "I don't like this. One sneeze and the whole place will come down on top of us." "The squad has a GPS tracker implanted in my neck. They'll come dig us out."
"Seriously?"
"No. Man up, Kev, we'll be fine." And I switched my torch on and stepped into number 16. I felt the decades worth of dust specks hanging suspended in the air, felt them shift and stir, rising up to whirl in cold little eddies around us. The stairs creaked and flexed ominously under our weight, but they held. I started with the top front room, where I had found Rosie's note and where, according to Ma and Da, the Polish boys had found her suitcase. There was a great jagged hole where they had ripped out the fireplace. The wall around it was crowded with faded graffiti explaining who loved who was gay, and who should fuck off. Somewhere on that fireplace, on the way to someone's Ballsbridge mansion, were my initials and Rosie's. The floor was littered with the same old predictable stuff, cans and butts and wrappers, but most of it was thick with dust. Kids had better places to hang out these days, and enough money to get into them. And, attractively, used condoms had been added to the mix. In my day, those were illegal. If you were lucky enough to get into a situation that called for one, you took your chances and spent the next few weeks shitting bricks. All the high corners were clotted with cobwebs, and there was a thin, cold wind whistling through the gaps around the sash windows. Any day now, those windows would be gone, sold to some merchant wanker whose wife wanted an adorable little touch of authenticity. I said, the place made me talk softly, "I lost my virginity in this room." I felt Kevin glance at me, wanting to ask, but he held back. He said, "I can think of a whole lot more comfortable places for a ride. We had a blanket, and comfort isn't everything. I wouldn't have swapped this dive for the penthouse of the Shelburne." After a moment, Kevin shivered. "God, this place is depressing. Think of it as atmosphere, a trip down memory lane." "Fuck that. I stay as far from memory lane as I can. Did you hear the dailies? How bloody miserable were Sundays in the 80s. Mass and then the shite Sunday dinner. How much do you want to bet it was boiled bacon, roast potatoes and cabbage?"
"Don't forget the pudding."
I ran the torch beam along the floorboards. A few minor holes, a few splintered ends. No mended patches. And in here, anything mended would have stuck out like a sore thumb. Angel Delight every time. Tasted like strawberry-flavored chalk, but if you didn't eat it, you were making the black babies starve.
"God, yeah. And then nothing to do all day long except hang out on the corner in the cold, unless you could bunk into the cinema, or unless you wanted to put up with Ma and Da. Nothing on the telly except Father Whoever's sermon about contraception making you go blind. And even for that, you had to spend hours messing around with those bloody rabbit ears trying to get the reception. By the end of some Sundays, I swear, I was so bored I was looking forward to school."
Nothing where the fireplace had been, or up the chimney. Just a bird's nest at the top, and years' worth of white droppings streaked down the sides. The chimney was barely wide enough to fit the suitcase. There was no way anyone could have got a grown woman's body up there, even temporarily. I said,
"I'm telling you, mate, you should have come in here. This was where all the action was. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
By the time I was old enough for the good action, nobody came in here anymore. There were rats. There always were. The added atmosphere. Come on." I headed into the next room. Kevin trailed after me. "They added germs. You weren't here for it, but someone put down poison or something. I think it was Mad Johnny, you know how he had that total thing about rats, because of being in the trenches or whatever. Anyway, a bunch of the rats crawled into the walls and died. And Jesus, I'm not kidding, the smell of them.
Worse than the piggeries. We'd have died of typhoid.
Smells fine to me.
I did the routine with the torch again. I was starting to wonder if I was on the world's stupidest wild goose chase. One night of my family, and the loony was already rubbing off all over me.
Well, yeah, obviously it went away after a while.
But by that time we'd all switched to hanging around in that empty lot up at the corner of Copper Lane. Do you know the one? It was shite, too. In winter you froze your balls off, and there were nettles and barbed wire all over the place. But all the kids from Copper Lane and Smith's Road hung out there, too, so you had a better chance of getting a drink or a snog or whatever you were after. So we never really came back here.
You missed out.
Yeah.
Kevin glanced around dubiously.
He had his hands in his pockets, keeping his jacket wrapped tightly around himself so it wouldn't touch anything.
I live. This kind of stuff is why I can't stand it when people get nostalgic about the 80s. Kids bored to death or playing with barbed wire or shagging in bloody rat holes.
What's to miss?
I looked at him, standing there in his Ralph Lauren logos and his snazzy watch and his slick upmarket haircut, all full up with righteous indignation and looking 1,000 miles out of place. I thought of him as a skinny, cowlicky kid in my patched hand-me-downs, running wild in and out of this house, without ever realizing it wasn't good enough.
I said, there was an awful lot more to it than that.
Like what? What's so great about losing your virginity in a shithole?
I'm not saying I'd bring the 80s back if I had the choice, but don't shove the baby down the plug hole with the bathwater. And I don't know about you, but I was never bored. Never.
You might want to have a think about that.
Kevin shrugged and mumbled something that sounded like, I don't have a clue what you're on about.
Keep thinking. It'll come to you.
I headed for the back rooms without bothering to wait for him. If he put his foot through a rotten floorboard in the shadows, that was his problem. After a moment, he came sulking after me. Nothing interesting in the back. Nothing interesting in the hall floor rooms. Except a huge stash of vodka empties that someone had apparently preferred not to put out with their rubbish. At the top of the basement steps, Kevin balked.
No way. I'm not going down there. Seriously, Frank.
Every time you say no to your big brother, God kills a kitten. Come on.
Kevin said, Shay locked us up down there once. You and me. I was only little. Do you remember that?
Nope. Is that why this place gives you the vapors?
It does not give me the fucking vapors. I just don't see why we're trying to get ourselves buried alive for no bloody reason at all.
I said, then wait for me outside.
After a moment, he shook his head. He followed me for the same reason I had wanted him there to begin with. Old habits last. I'd been down in that basement maybe 3 times, total. The local urban legend claims that someone called Slasher Higgins had slit his deaf-mute brother's throat and buried him down there. If you invaded Gimpy Higgins's territory, he would come after you, waving his rotten hands and making terrible grunting sounds. Cue demonstration. The Higgins brothers had probably been invented by worried parents, and none of us believed in them. But we still stayed out of the basement. Shay and his mates sometimes hung out down there to show what hard men they were, and a couple might go there if they were truly desperate for a shag and all the other rooms were otherwise occupied. But the good stuff happened upstairs. The 10 packs of Marlboros and the cheap 2-litre bottles of cider, the matchstick thin spliffs and the games of strip poker that never got more than halfway. Once, when Zippy Hearn and I were about 9, we dared each other to touch the back wall of the basement, and had a vague memory of bringing Michelle Nugent down there a few years later, in the hope that it would scare her enough to make her grab hold of me and possibly snog me. No such luck. Even at that age, I went for girls who didn't scare easy. The other time had been when Shay locked the two of us in. He'd left us there for what was probably an hour. It felt like days. Kevin had been 2 or 3, and he had been too terrified even to scream. He had pissed his cacks instead. I had told him it would be okay. Tried to kick the door down, tried to pry the boards off the windows with my fingers, and swore to myself that someday I would beat the living shit out of Shay. I moved the torch in a slow sweep. The basement
was a lot like I remembered it, except that now I could see exactly why our parents might have had issues with us hanging out here. The windows were still boarded up, badly, with thin stripes of pale light falling in between the slats. The ceiling was bulging in a way I didn't like, and great chunks of plaster had fallen away so that the beams showed, bent and splintering. The dividing walls had buckled and crumbled till it was basically all one huge room, and in places the floor was collapsing in on itself, sagging into the foundations. Subsidence, maybe, with nothing to prop the house up on the end of terrace side. A very long time ago, someone had made an unimpressive effort, before giving up on the place altogether, to patch up a few of the more major holes by shoving slabs of concrete into them and hoping for the best. The place smelled like I remembered. Piss, mould and dirt. Only more so. "Ah, man," Kevin muttered unhappily, hovering at the bottom of the stairs. "Ah, man." His voice echoed off into the far corners, bouncing off walls at odd angles, so that it sounded like someone was murmuring, away in the dark. He winced and shut up. Two of the concrete slabs were man-sized, and whoever had put them in had slapped lumpy cement around the edges for the satisfaction of a job well done. The third one was even more half-arsed, just a lob-sided chunk, maybe 4 feet by 3, and fuck the cement. "Right," Kevin said, a notch too loudly, behind me. "There you go. The gaff is still here, and it's still a dive. Can we go now, yeah?" I moved carefully into the middle of the floor and pressed a corner of the slab with the toe of my boot. There were years of grime holding it in place, but when I put my weight down, I felt a very faint shift. It was rocking. If I had had some kind of lever, if there had been an iron bar or a chunk of metal in one of the heaps of debris in the corners, I could have lifted it. "Kev," I said, "think back for me. Those rats that died in the walls. Was that the winter I left?" Kevin's eyes slowly widened. The sickly grey bands of light made him look transparent, like a projection flickering on a screen. "Ah, Jesus, Frank. Ah, no. I'm asking you a question. Just after I split, rats in the walls, yes or no?" "Frank. Yes or no? It was only rats, Frank. They were all over this place. We saw them, a load of times." So that, by the time the weather warmed up, there would have been nothing left to cause a serious stink and start people complaining to the landlord, or the corpo. "And smelled them. Rotting." After a moment, Kevin said, finally, "Yeah." I said, "Come on." I got a hold of his arm, too hard, but I couldn't loosen my grip, and steered him up the stairs ahead of me, fast, feeling boards twist and splinter under our feet. By the time we got out onto the steps, into the sweep of cool, damp breeze and fine rain, I had my phone in my other hand, and I was dialing the tech bureau. The tech I got hold of was not a happy bunny, either about working the weekend shift or about being dragged out of his nice, warm geek pen. I told him that I had information indicating that a body had been dumped under a concrete slab in the basement of number 16 Faithful Place. I didn't go into minor details like dates. That I needed a bureau team and a couple of uniforms, and that I might or might not be on the scene by the time they arrived. The tech made weaselly noises about search warrants, till I informed him that any possible suspect would have been an intruder on the premises, and therefore could have had no expectation of privacy, and, when he kept whining, that in any case, the house had been in public use for at least 30 years, and therefore counted as a de facto public place by right of season. No warrant needed. I wasn't sure how well either of these would hold up in court, but that was some other day's problem, and it shut the tech up. I filed him in my mental database under Useless Prick for future reference. Kevin and I waited for the tech and his buddies on the steps of the student gaff at number 11, close enough to give me a good view, far enough that with a little look, no one would associate me with what was going to be happening. If this went down the way I thought it would, I needed the place to see me as their homecoming homeboy, not as a cop. I lit a smoke and pointed the packet at Kevin, who shook his head. "What are we doing?" he asked.
staying out of the way.
Do you not need to be there?
The techs are big boys, I said, and girls. They can do their job without me holding their hands.